I'm Dave Knutson, the village philosopher, and we're fortunate tonight to have a guest with us who's not a regular member of the faculty this week. He's visiting the village. He was happy to help us out with Reformation and Renaissance. This is Jean Olson, and she teaches at, the name is San Francisco Seminary, it's San Anselmo, California. Her specialty is Reformation history, and her general area is church history, and that's where she teaches most of her courses. Jean is going to talk to us tonight on the topic, Renaissance, Reformation, what's this all about? And we hope we'll have some discussion, too, that will lead into the festival for tomorrow, things that you might have been contemplating that you would like to do or enact or be. Jean will be a resource person for that, too. So, too.
Right. What I plan to do is take 45 minutes to describe the Renaissance and Reformation and put them in their, situate them in time. And obviously I can't take it all, so I will attempt to deal with aspects of it that other people won't be dealing with tomorrow and the day after. And then I'll open the floor for questions. And I've been told to be as concrete as possible so that people can get an idea of what life was like at the time. So I will attempt to do that too. The two terms that we're dealing with here, Renaissance and Reformation, are labels that we've put on the past that people themselves weren't necessarily using in the same way as we use them. And Renaissance means rebirth of antiquity. We'll talk a little more about that later. And Reformation, with a capital R, refers to reform of the church or reshaping of the church. Now, both Renaissance and Reformation are periods in history, or we thought of them as periods in history, and also movements. And that makes dating them a little difficult, unless you happen to be a historian and like to think of flexible dates and all of that. Because, for instance, if you go to a Renaissance fair, you will find that they've got a lot of things from Elizabethan England, the latter half of the 16th century, and sort of Shakespeare. If you've been to a Shakespearean play, you know, the costumes look the same. And then they've got a few things from the medieval period that they just put in there because they're not too careful about detail. But the point is, the Elizabethan England that was Renaissance England in the latter 16th century was not Renaissance Italy, because by then in Italy, Michelangelo had already painted the Sistine Chapel, and Leonardo da Vinci had done the Last Supper in Milan, and the Renaissance popes were dead, and they were into the serious business of the Counter-Reformation. So when we talk about Renaissance, it depends a little bit which country you're in and when, because it's more of a cultural and intellectual movement than something that you can just pin a date on, like you can the fall of Rome, for instance, in the late 15th century. And people might disagree whether that had any particular significance or not, but at least it's a date. And that isn't quite the case with the Renaissance and Reformation. So on the board, when I put down the dates, I put the Renaissance, which can begin as early as 1350. Don't be too literal about that, because that was the year in which Europe was faced with the bubonic plague. So about 1350 in some parts of Europe, and lasted as late as 1600 in some parts of Europe. And I'll be doing the same thing with the Protestant Reformation. We'll have flexible dates depending on whether you're looking at it from a Protestant or Catholic point of view, and to some extent where you are. But that's less of a problem than is the Renaissance. When we're talking about parts of Europe where you have the Renaissance, in the latter part of the 14th century, it's largely Italy. Italy is thought of as the place where this happened first. And the usual story is, with historians, welcome everybody, we're still at the very beginning of the Renaissance in Italy. The usual story is that because towns and cities didn't decline completely in Italy after the fall of ancient Rome, and because it was located on the Mediterranean, convenient to trade in the Mediterranean, that it was a likely spot for something to happen, particularly since by the 14th century you had a considerable amount of trade out of Italy, especially on seaports like Venice and Genoa. And this brought in money, and it meant that there were merchants, as well as just clergy and farmers. There were merchants, and then the merchants living in cities needed artisans to work for them, and because they had enough money, could hire artists and buy books, manuscripts at that time before the printing press, and make the Renaissance. Well, that makes some sense, I think, but you can't be too economically deterministic about it, because then we would expect a Renaissance in every place where there was money, even Texas. And obviously, it's not a one-to-one correlation. But there is something to be said for the fact that you had certain people in society in Italy who had time and enough means to have interests in something other than just protecting themselves and making their daily living. And what you did have then by the latter 14th century was lots of little Italian cities, or for the time, relatively big Italian cities, politically organized into city-states, because Italy doesn't unite as a nation until the late 19th century. And this city would have land about it, like Florence and Milan and Ravenna and Venice, a city with land about it. And then the city-states were sort of more or less constantly at war with one another about boundaries and seaports and so on. Florence, for instance, needed Pisa on the ocean, on the sea, for its port, and it protected that as carefully as it could when it could get it. And so they were constantly at war. So besides having money for culture and art and education, they also had money for war. But it was an exciting time in Italian history, and a time that one of the great historians of the Renaissance, called Jacob Burckhardt, said was important because it was a time of what he thought he saw as the rise of individualism. Now, you have to be very careful with that, too, because if you say that there was individualism in Europe beginning in Italy only in the late 14th century, what do you do with the centuries that went before? And there has been a lot of criticism of that, particularly by people who are interested in medieval history, because they say we had individualists in the 12th and 13th and 14th centuries, too, or 12th and 13th, people like Thomas Aquinas and so on. So again, the arguments of some historians don't make entire sense. But there was something going on in Italy in the 14th century, and it was manifesting itself in art and architecture and culture, particularly by a change in taste from the centuries that had gone before. Artistically, there was money now, not just for what it had been used for in centuries before, largely altarpieces and church decoration, but to decorate the homes of some of these people. And you had in pictures then not just the Virgin and Saint Sebastian of the medieval period, but also wealthy Italians. Now often they are the Virgin and the saints themselves. They'll appear in the picture as one of the saints, but it's very clearly a picture of some Italian. And in some paintings, like paintings of the Last Supper, which were popular, you'll have standing around the table, sort of at the fringes, Italian burgers and somebody's dog. And that's one of the ways in which we can tell how people dressed, very sumptuously. And the women in long dresses, and the men in various types of garbs, often silk stockings and sometimes coats that went down to about the knees, but or shorter. But very expensive material, silk, velvets, and the like. All right, so we have this this wealth around it. It was expressed in clothing, in the paintings that were painted, paintings that were then done not just for churches but for private patrons. And then the architects, too, were not building churches alone, but expensive homes, palaces, they were called. When we think of a palace, we think of a building that's got a lot of green grass around it. This was not true of these Italian city-state palaces. They were located in these very small cities, and so they were right up against the street. But they were expensive buildings, and they were expensively done, and they were owned by wealthy individuals within the city. So all of this is beginning to happen then in the 14th century in Italy. And along with this then is a change in taste in education and in interests. After the fall of Rome, during what became to be called the Dark Ages, there wasn't much education about. And if you wanted some, you went to a monastery and became a monk or a nun. Then later on, the universities were founded in cities in Europe again in the 11th and 12th century, and there was a possibility of university education, but even then it was still pretty much with the idea in mind that you would become a priest. So in Italy, we have these merchants that aren't interested in becoming priests, and they want a different kind of an education. They want to be educated in accounting and this more practical skills. But they also have cultural interests of their own and an interest particularly in antiquity, that is, in ancient Greece and Rome. And there were among them particular groups of scholars who called themselves or were called humanists. Now, humanist in the 19th, 20th century sense of the term usually means somebody that has goodwill to people but does not believe in God or isn't sure about God. But humanist in the Renaissance and Reformation meant someone who was interested particularly in antiquity, in the humanities, studies, rhetoric, literature, poetry, history, fields that had not been particularly given attention during the centuries that went before. So there were, and language above all, language both the ancient Greek and Latin, and the vernacular languages, Italian, and in the north it would be French and German. So these people, the humanists, are looking down their noses then at the centuries that went before, which were largely devoted to theology and philosophy, and also to certain ways of expressing oneself. There was a form of theological debate that was done in a dialectic fashion, where you'd present the opponent's argument, and then you'd give your own, and it was all very back and forth and stylized and difficult to read and not too persuasive. Well, the humanists used a more rhetorical style, and they would read the ancient Romans, especially Cicero, who's quite rhetorical, and they would copy him. So we have these humanists then looking at the past, looking down their noses at the past, except the way back, as my daughter would say, ancient Rome and ancient Greece, which they glorified. They thought it was a wonderful time, a golden age. Their idea then was not to look ahead to the future, to some future date where things would be better and better because of technological advance or whatever, but to look to the past, to antiquity, and to bring that back to life again. Now, what this meant is that they wanted to have the most original manuscripts and the best Latin and Greek, mainly the best Latin, though, because they noted when they read the ancient authors that the Latin of Rome was not the Latin of the Middle Ages. And they thought of that Latin then as having been perverted. And they wanted to bring the language back to the original pure Latin of the Romans. So if you read the Latin of the Renaissance and Reformation, it's more like that of ancient Rome than the centuries in between. Now, interestingly enough, at the same time that they were very interested in these ancient languages, they weren't just thinking in those terms, they thought in terms of expression in their own vernacular languages too. Italian in the case of Italy, or French, and so on. So it was language per se that they were interested in. But this whole movement expressed itself in a very snobbish attitude toward the past. The Dark Ages, they called it. They thought of it as barbaric. The architecture of the time, they called Gothic. In derision, you see, not in appreciation of Notre Dame and Chartres and all the beautiful cathedrals of the 11th, 12th, 13th century, but in derision. They thought of themselves as coming out of a dark age and coming into the light, and they were in a period of rebirth of antiquity. So this was their general frame of mind then, the humanists of the Renaissance. And many people thought of themselves as having this kind of education and this kind of attitude. Beginning with the person who is thought of as being the father of the humanists, and his name was Petrarch. And he lived in the latter 14th century. He didn't even live in Italy, although he was Florentine. He lived in Avignon in France. This was the period when the French monarch had moved the papacy from Rome to southern France, Avignon. So Petrarch lived near Avignon and wrote from Avignon, but he had his following back in Italy. And he wrote poems to Laura, who was a woman that he was infatuated with, someone else's wife, but the poems are quite lovely, and also in Latin. And he encouraged people to learn Greek, because they'd forgotten Greek in the centuries that had gone before. He was sort of a hero to the educated people of the time, particularly back in Florence where he came from. Well, there were other people like this who thought of themselves as in his footsteps back at home in Italy, not just in Florence, but in the other cities as well. And they took up the same studies and the same cause. They'd buy up old manuscripts and have them recopied. They would bring in Greek people, Greek-speaking people, to learn Greek again so that they could read Greek. And they would devote quite a bit of their time and energies to these kinds of studies. Now, how did you afford this? One nice way was to be rich, and this is what some people were. If you were a wealthy person, you might this might be your hobby, especially if you had somebody else, younger children and sons and so on, to do manage the business for you. You might take this as your prime interest. That was one way. Another way, if you weren't rich, was to find someone who would be your patron. Just as the artists and the architects of the time would find a wealthy person to be their patron, so would the humanists. And they would have somebody to support them, and then they would write and carry on literary discussions and the like. Because one thing that was very characteristic of the humanists was that they didn't sit off by themselves and study. They gathered in groups. Solidarities, they'd call them in Northern Europe. But in the cities, there'd be sort of a clique of these educated people that would gather periodically and discuss topics such as whether or not it was better to lead a contemplative life, the medieval ideal, or an active life of what they called civic humanism, active in the city. That was a topic of discussion. Whether Franciscan poverty was better or wealth. And then they discuss old manuscripts and the like, too. So you had, in these various cities of Italy, groups of people that gathered together. Some of the humanists were in orders themselves. They were Franciscans or Dominicans or monks or priests. Some of them were city secretaries. They got, it was kind of a chief administrative position in some of these Italian cities. Another thing you could do if you had interests along these lines was you could become a tutor to the family of a wealthy man, a prince. And they did that. The wealthy duke or prince or merchant would hire somebody, a humanist, to educate his children. And that was very nice because he also educated his girls, not just his boys. But he would educate the whole family. So you had some quite educated women coming out of this system. But it was not a system for everybody. This was a system of education for the elite. There wasn't any real attempt to reach everybody. But that was the way it was in the Renaissance. Obviously, some of this filtered down to everybody because the music, the art, that was available. Some of it was in private homes, and everybody didn't have access to it, but many people did. All right, this was the scene in Italy then, beginning about the late 4th century into the 15th and the early 16th century. And there's some familiar names that come out of that period. The Medici family, for instance, the great family in Florence that provided the Pope that was around when Martin Luther was having trouble, Leo. This was a great family in Florence, a great and wealthy family that was a patron to art and artists. It was the family to which Machiavelli wrote The Prince to one of the Lorenzo de' Medici. It provided these popes, as I said. Another name that you may not ring a bell to you quite as easily is somebody named Salutati. There were a number of great Italians in this period who have left their literary work behind. Now, this movement spread, or movement or cultural manifestations, or whatever you want to call it, spread beyond Italy. Not like gangrene across the Alps, but through a process of people coming to Italy to study, because there were little universities in these cities, and it became quite the thing for people from Northern Europe to complete their education by going to Italy, or a part of their education would be in Italy. They always talked about going across the Alps to sunny Italy, and they'd go and study for a while in Italy, and they'd pick up these ideas, and they'd bring them back. That was one way in which the Renaissance was going to spread. Another way was that the manuscripts and later the books of Italy were to spread across the Alps and be disseminated elsewhere. And then some of the Italians themselves moved out. And it was a time in which Northern Europe was looking to Italy as sort of a cultural leader. So the courts of Northern Europe would try to imitate Italy with a certain amount of resentment at the same time, because they thought that the Italians were too pejorative and they felt too superior. So it was kind of a mixed bag. But it did spread across the Alps then. But later, obviously, more like the late 15th century, and it took root in a different way in each of the countries of Northern Europe. So you had somewhat similar art and architecture, but it was, you know, there was a Flemish style. And you had an effect on the universities of Europe at this time, but some and not all. Cambridge in England, but not the Sorbonne in Paris very much. And you had humanists in the north too then, but they tended to be called Christian humanists, not just average Italian humanists. Not that the Italians were not Christians. Everybody was baptized in those days, except Jews and Moors down in Spain. But because they had the humanists in the north, when they looked to antiquity, looked not just primarily to the ancient pagan Romans, but to the church fathers. And the best known of the Christian humanists in the north of Europe was Erasmus. And Erasmus, part of what he did in this enormous literary production of a lifetime, was to see to it that quite a number of old manuscripts from people like Origen and other church fathers got published, because Erasmus was around when the printing press had come into use for about half a century, and he wanted to see that these things were edited and published. So the humanists of the north that had this interest in antiquity took a particular interest in the church fathers, in Christian antiquity, in the Bible as well. One of the things that Erasmus saw too is that the Bible in Greek was published so that people could use it, both those who knew Greek and those who wanted to translate Greek into the vernacular. So you have a number of these people in the various countries of Europe, and the educational system is affected, and to some extent the art and music too. Now this then is the situation into which the Reformation is going to fall. In Germany in particular, you had humanists who were nationalistic in spirit. They liked what Italy had to offer, but they didn't like the dominance that Italy had over the church, and they didn't think Germany was appreciated enough for what it was. So you had the same groups of humanists that got together in various German cities, and there was a nationalistic tone. Well, this sets the tone then. We're getting ready for the Reformation. One of the things the humanists did when they looked at the church was to be quite critical of what they felt was superstitious in the church, particularly Erasmus. He didn't like pilgrimages. He didn't like relics of saints. He didn't like things which he considered hypocritical. And he wanted sort of a reform of life and morals in the church, which many modern people look to today as sort of something that should have happened instead of Luther. If you've read a lot of history books, Jesuits are particularly fond of Erasmus recently. But into this picture then, Luther comes, and he has, in part, a humanist education, but not very much so. he learned Greek well. He was a doctor of Bible. But his education was largely in medieval theology and philosophy, except that he kept studying throughout his lifetime, and he read the ancients as well, and turned out to be quite well educated humanistically as well as theologically in the old medieval style. And Luther, of course, came to the conclusion that the medieval theology was off the track. Medieval theology had developed to the point where quite a bit of initiative was placed on humankind. The prevailing idea was that if you did what was in you, that God could not refuse you his grace. Kind of a neat system if you think of it, because you've sort of got a promise. The problem with Luther was, and many others, is they couldn't do what was in them. They could never make, he felt he could never make a complete confession of his sins, for instance, that he couldn't take the first step. As you all remember from your small catechism, he makes a big point that it's God that takes the first step, not humans, and that I cannot believe in Jesus Christ, my Lord, etc., in the explanation the commandments. So Luther, in his studies of the Bible, comes to the conclusion that a lot of medieval theology is simply wrong, specifically this basic orientation that puts so much of the responsibility on humans. And then, of course, along with that, all the accoutrements of late medieval theology had institutionalized purgatory and the treasury of merit, and much that simply didn't appear in the Bible. And you're all aware that the thing that set this all off was the sale of a great indulgence throughout Europe to help pay for the rebuilding of St. Peter's in Rome. The same St. Peter's you see when you go to Rome today was the one they were building in the early 16th century, and the popes needed money, and this moved them to a great sale of indulgences. Now, what was an indulgence? An indulgence was the remission of the temporal penalty still left after your sins are forgiven. Now, obviously, you have to be in a certain frame of mind to think that there is any temporal penalty left after your sins are forgiven. But the way medieval theology had worked itself out, you not only were forgiven for your sins, but there was something left over. It wasn't entirely nonsensical in a way, because as people well know, things follow from their sins that even after they've repented of them, which they wouldn't like, physical and moral disasters and the like. But if you didn't work this all out in your lifetime, you would work it out in purgatory, which was a time of purgation before you went to heaven. And you can read all about that in Dante's Divine Comedy, because he has sort of put this all down in beautiful Italian poetry, starting with hell and then moving to purgatory and then to heaven. And this was commonly believed at the time. The reason the church could have something to say about this is the church controlled a treasury of merit. In a balanced system, the extra merit left over from Christ and from the saints who had lived lives that were above and beyond the call of duty and had gathered merit, which they then was in a treasury of merit, which the church could dispense. Now, originally the idea was that you would do some holy act, attend mass, do penance in some way, and thus receive an indulgence. But by the late 15th century, you could buy indulgences. And by this early 16th century, not only for yourself, but for your parents, say. So the kind of indulgences that were being peddled around Europe at the time, that Martin Luther was hearing about this, were called a plenary indulgence for all your years in purgatory and those of your parents too. Now, the way this was supposed to be done is that the person, and it wasn't just anybody who could sell these. It had to be, usually it was a Dominican priest, but it didn't have to be a Dominican. But there was somebody out encouraging people to buy these, and he was supposed to be encouraging them to confess their sins and, you know, go through the whole procedure that you went through to have your sins forgiven. But it got to be just simply a money transaction. And Luther was very angry at this. And it sort of brought matters to a head. And it wasn't that the matter wasn't important, because it was really, it symbolized the whole attitude of late medieval theology. it wasn't just an incidental thing, that if it hadn't happened, there might not have been a Reformation, because Luther was going to be at odds with this whole attitude, one, that the church, that the doctrine of the church would keep evolving beyond Scripture, and two, that so much relied on human initiative. So, but initially, he's mainly objecting to these indulgences in the 95 Thesis, which he then gets together in on Halloween of 1517. And this is the date, then, that we Lutherans usually pick for the beginning of the Reformation, 1517. Not all Protestants would agree, but many would. Some French Protestants don't like that date because they like to think the Reformation is having started somewhat earlier in France, with people like Lefebvre de Top and the like. But that's a minority voice. I think most Protestants are going to be happy with 1517 for the beginning. And the man that he's particularly angry at is a man named Tetzel, who was selling indulgences near Wittenberg, where Luther was teaching at the time. And Tetzel was a Dominican, very fat, and wore a white robe, the incidental to anybody who wants to become Tetzel. And I'm not going to say too much about Luther, because you know a fair bit about him and other people can talk about him, except to say that it was very fortuitous indeed, or providential, depending on your point of view, that the printing press was well enough developed at this time. Remember the Gutenberg Bible of the 15th century? This is the early 16th century. There are printing presses about, hand presses, but presses, developed to the point where things could be gotten out fairly easily. It wasn't like early Renaissance Italy, where everything had to be hand copied and sent about. Now they could be printed. And the printers picked up what Luther had to say and printed it and sold it. And it got disseminated very widely, especially some of the shorter pieces. And Luther did a lot of little polemical things, and some of them very good, like the three treatises of 1520 on Christian liberty and the Babylonian captivity of the church and the address to the nobles of the German nation. These were nice, readable pieces. At least 16th century people thought they were quite short and readable, and easy to print up and sell. And there weren't any copyright laws in those days, and they got printed up and they got sold very fast and sent not just around Germany, but they were translated and sent into France, into Switzerland. Some of them came over to England. Luther's word got out, and it sold very well. And this is important, obviously, to the spread of the Reformation, the fact that the printing press was around. All right, now I don't want to say too much more about Luther. You're obviously all aware that he didn't work alone. There were other people at the University of Wittenberg who worked with him, and one of the most interesting of whom was the young Melanchthon, who came to teach Greek at the university there and became the author of the Augsburg Confession and so on. Luther liked Melanchthon for several reasons, but one of them was his great skill with languages. Melanchthon was the nephew of a humanist by the name of Reuchlin, who had introduced Hebrew again into the educated circles and had his books burned by the church because he learned the Hebrew from Jews and it was thought of as a Jewish language. And the humanists were up in arms at the burning of the books, but there was resistance to what had happened. So that's a little bit of Melanchthon's background. He's a nephew of this man, and very well educated indeed. All right, I'm going to say more about some of the reformers that you haven't heard as much about. So we'll move somewhat south to Switzerland. That wasn't as big a move in the 16th century because Switzerland was still very informally a part of the Holy Roman Empire, which Germany was a part of. Germany wasn't united again until the late 19th century, and it was the Germanies. A lot of little dukedoms and disjointed territorial units that shifted boundaries, but were all sort of loosely together under the Holy Roman Emperor. And this was an empire, but loose. And Switzerland was becoming more and more independent. They did pretty much what they wanted to do. So we're going to move down to Zurich, which if you're in banking circles today, you'll recognize for something other than the Protestant Reformation. But in Zurich, there was a reformer by the name of Ulrich Zwingli. Zwingli, in background, was a priest too, like Luther, but he wasn't an Augustinian. Zwingli was what was called a secular priest, one who was a parish priest. He wasn't a regular priest, one who lived according to a regular rule. But he was a very well-educated young man. His family sent him to the university in Switzerland, which was in Basel, and then he went off to Vienna, and then he came back to be a priest of a little town, and was eventually called to become the preacher at the great church in Zurich. And that was a great honor indeed. And he was a good preacher, and also a well-educated man. He'd sort of somewhat self-taught, but he was a musician, he knew Greek, he was a humanist. And when he came to the great church in Zurich, he already had some of what we would call Reformed ideas. One of the things he did is that he dropped the lectionary, and instead of preaching on the prescribed texts, he started at the beginning of the New Testament and preached right through. He was a marvelous preacher, and the people came to hear, and the people included the city council. And after months and years of preaching like this, they came to the conclusion that they wanted to do away with the Mass, that they wanted to eat meat on Friday, a lot of the accoutrements of the Reformation that were also happening in the Germanies. And they held a big debate in town. That was often what was done when a city became Protestant. And then they'd decide, aha, the Protestant side is right, and they'd change over. They'd become Reformed. It was all done legally, you see. You didn't just sort of cause a Reformation. You had to get, in the case of a city like Zurich, the city council to see that it was done legally. In the case of a place like Wittenberg, you had to get the favor of the overlord, the elector Frederick. So it was important to get the legal processes going when these changes were made. Well, in Zurich, it was the city council then, with the help of the preaching of Zwingli and others, that made the changes. Now, some of the changes that Ulrich Zwingli wanted were different from those that Luther wanted. Zwingli had the idea that if it wasn't in Scripture, let's not have it. Now, what that meant in a church service is that you didn't just translate the Mass into German, which is essentially what Luther did with a different understanding of the Eucharist. You started more from scratch. You did away with anything that was a distraction. Music was a distraction. Even though Zwingli was a great musician, he thought that music was distracting in the service. So they took the organ out, they whitewashed the walls, they did all sorts of things which sort of interfere with our own artistic and musical interests. But he did that not just because he didn't like art, he obviously did, but because he thought that these things were popish and that they were a distraction from the hearing of the word, which was a central message of the Reformation wherever you went. Zwingli died in battle a couple years after he had a big debate with Luther at Marburg, called the Marburg Colloquy, in which they couldn't come to an agreement on the Lord's Supper. Zwingli, like Luther, got married. He married a widow with a number of children. He died in battle fighting for Zurich, and a man named Bullinger took over. Well, there were leaders like this in the various cities that became Reformed. Some of the names you haven't heard, and some you haven't wondered about them. Like in Basel, there was a man named Oikulum Padius. In Strasbourg, there was Bucer and Capito. There were different people in the different areas that led the Reformation with the help of the government units involved, because the people on the city councils or the overlords were also citizens of the area. Now, those were the first generation reformers. The reform keeps on into a second generation, and it's in that generation that we come to John Calvin, who's French. Born in a relatively small town north of Paris, the son of a notary, well-educated with some of the local nobles, and then sent off to Paris, where he got a very good education and seemed to be in line to become a priest. That was the plan. Then his father, the notary, got in trouble with the local religious and decided he didn't want his son to become a priest after all. He wanted him to become a lawyer. And those were the days where dutiful sons did what their father asked them to do, and John went off and studied law and was about to get a doctorate in law when his father died. And his father did die, and Calvin finished the doctorate in law, but then went back to Paris to study theology. Well, during the course of all these studies and the people he met en route and the his reading, he apparently became a Protestant, although he talks about it as if it were a conversion. He says, "My heart was subdued to teachableness." And he gets in trouble in Paris because of a speech that a friend of his gave at the Sorbonne on All Saints Day, November 1st, and the two of them flee Paris because it's dangerous in that country. The King Francis I is burning Protestants, a Roman Catholic king, and he travels about in areas in France where there are nobles that are favorable to Protestantism, and ends up in Basel, Switzerland, which is reformed, and writes The Institutes, which is published in 1536. Now, this is his great work that is edited five or six times throughout his life in Latin and French, and he redoes it and expands it, although he doesn't change many of his ideas, throughout his lifetime. And it's more of a systematic theology than anything Luther ever did. It's long and it's organized, and it asks the same questions that medieval theologians were asking about how do you know that God exists and this sort of thing. And he asks them, and then he answers them in what we would consider a Protestant way. Much of the theology therein you would find quite Lutheran. And Calvin didn't see himself at odds with Luther either. Well, this book becomes a bestseller. In a sense, they didn't have bestsellers, but it did very well. And Calvin was surprised because his first book, which was on Seneca, he had a humanist education to some extent, it hadn't done well. And he is well known right away because of it. So when he is on his way back and forth from France into Switzerland again, he has to stay overnight in Geneva, which is a newly reformed city. And the local reformer, who is a Frenchman by the name of Farel, prevails upon him to stay in the city and help with the Reformation, because they'd gotten rid of all the monks and nuns, but they didn't have anything set up in its place as well as Farel would have liked. Well, Calvin doesn't want to stay, but he does. And he starts out as a lecturer on scripture there and then becomes a city pastor. But he wants changes that the city council doesn't want. He would like to have the reform reflect itself in the life of the people. In particular, he would like some control of marriage laws in the hands of the pastors. And there are various points of dissension between the city council and Calvin and the pastors. And finally, then, the pastors refuse at one point to give communion on one of the four Sundays in the year that they're giving communion. And the city council is up in arms and asks Calvin and Farel and another man to leave town. So he leaves town, goes to Basel, decides to set himself up as a scholar again, and lo and behold, the people from Strasbourg ask him to come. They've got French refugees in Strasbourg, which is a relatively tolerant reformed city. And these refugees from Roman Catholic France are coming in, and there's no one to serve them. So Calvin becomes the pastor of the French refugee congregation there. He also gets married during this period to a widow with a number of children. And he likes it there. He attends, there were some meetings of Roman Catholics and Protestants held, 1539 to 1541, in an attempt to bring the church together again so that there isn't a split. And he attends these, and he meets people like Melanchthon, who he likes very much, and corresponds with, as a matter of fact, for the rest of his life. And then he wants to stay there, but the city of Geneva, which has changed city council members, isn't doing as well as they'd like without him, and they prevail upon him to come back. And he says, "Well, I'll come back if you let things be more my way. For one thing, I want to write up some church laws when I get back." So he comes back to Geneva in 1541 after several years away, and one of the first things he does is to write up the ecclesiastical ordinances of the city. He also rewrote the city's laws at the request of the city council, but that was not a particular interest to him, and he didn't really change anything. He just codified them because of his legal background. But the ecclesiastical ordinances were important. And in these ordinances, he describes a fourfold system of church office: pastors, elders, deacons, and doctors, all of which he felt he found in the New Testament. Pastors, that's fairly obvious what they are. Doctors were professors, not a medical doctor, but a professor, and he particularly thought in terms of professor of scripture or theology in a school. Elders were people from the city council of Geneva who would sit with the pastors on a body which was called the consistory. And the consistory once a week would meet in the afternoon and hear cases of people who'd gotten into trouble. Now, trouble in Geneva was defined as anything from theft to marital problems. So people would be brought in if their neighbors heard that their marriages weren't going well. And people lived very close together in this tight little town, so they heard this through the windows. Or people would be brought in because they'd blasphemed, this sort of thing. But the whole idea of the consistory was to be an agent of reconciliation. So sometimes they'd bring in people that were quarreling, and they would actually become reconciled right there. And what you have when you read the records of this consistory is a lot of the local gossip about town being discussed before these ministers and city council members that were the elders. What amazes you in reading it is not the big brother mentality, which doesn't seem to be as prominent as the idea that there was a constant concern for everybody in the community. The other side of this concern of making sure everything was going right was that the poor should be cared for, and that was the job of the deacons. The deacons ran the city hospital, but they also ran a number of other funds that were set up for foreigners. No welfare fund in the 16th century, no hospital wanted to handle everybody from abroad, from another country. And Geneva was being inundated with French refugees and Italian refugees as well. Protestants fleeing Roman Catholic areas where they were not allowed to practice their religion or where their relatives had been burned. And they could come then to Geneva and live there for a little while and move on maybe to another Swiss city, but be granted haven. And there was a time in the 1550s where the population of the little city was actually doubled. And what happened is that everybody would share their bed, literally. They would have three or four people in a bed. And they built the city up and out because they had city walls. So they couldn't go beyond the city walls. They built out into the gardens and up above. And the streets were very narrow, and sanitation conditions being what they were, it was all very smelly. And people were living tightly close together in this town. But they accommodated the refugees, and they not only saw that they had a place to stay and something to eat, but they saw to it that they got jobs, they got the tools they needed, they got themselves set up in business. That was the job of the deacons. Now, Calvin's great talent, besides being a theologian, was that he could get people involved, and he could delegate responsibility. He didn't have to do it all himself. He had the deacons taking care of the poor, and then there were the elders and the other pastors on the consistory, and it was more of a cooperative, collegial effort that all of this happened. And it set up a great pattern for Reformed churches, which was followed in France and the Netherlands and England and Scotland with these various church offices with their duties. And these churches kept in touch with each other and in touch with Geneva, because Geneva was one of the few places where if you spoke French, you could be a Protestant. So they printed books. They printed, in the 1550s especially, there were a great number of religious books printed in Geneva, and they would send them back illegally into France in a great missionary endeavor to try to evangelize France. And little Protestant congregations got started in France. Of course, it was illegal. They didn't have any ministers, and they'd send to Geneva, and they'd say, we need a minister, and they'd send somebody out from the Genevan Academy, where they were then educating ministers, to be the minister in France, and if it got too dangerous, he'd come back again. And many of these people were martyred, burned in France because of their religious beliefs. Now, in addition to French and Italian refugees, you had some from England in the 1550s. England, you all probably have heard of Henry VIII and his need to legitimize the child that Anne Boleyn was pregnant with by marrying her, his mistress, and needing to divorce his first wife, and the church would not agree to it. So with the help of Thomas Cromwell, his agent, he declared himself supreme over the church in England. That was the Protestant Reformation beginning in the 1530s in England, but that didn't mean very much for the grassroots. Henry, when he died, then was followed by his son, who was a minor, and there was a group of people in power who were more Protestant than Henry had been. But at the death of Edward, the next in line for the throne was his oldest daughter, Mary, who was a Roman Catholic, the daughter of his first wife, who was a Roman Catholic, and also very bitter because she'd been divorced by Henry. And she set about, in the 1550s, to turn England Catholic again and burn the people who didn't want to go along with this. Well, obviously, quite a few people fled in refuge to the continent. And they were not too well received in Lutheran areas in Germany. There was some movement in that direction, but it didn't work out. They tended to go to areas that were reformed along the Zwinglian or the Calvinist model. In particular, they came to Geneva, and then after 3 or 4 years, when it was safe to go back, because Mary died, Bloody Mary she was called, she died, and then the next one in line was Elizabeth, daughter of Anne Boleyn, who was a Protestant, and it was safe to return again. They came back, and when they came back, they were hoping that the English church would become like the church was in Geneva. And, of course, it didn't. Elizabeth wanted a much more pragmatic system. The 39 Articles were vague. There were still bishops. The ministers were still wearing these white gowns, the surplices over, and there were a lot of things these people who'd lived in Geneva didn't like. And they became the Puritan element who tried to purify the Church of England and ran into quite a bit of trouble attempting that. But it's interesting that this refugee experience was very important, because up until then you had a great deal of Lutheran input. The original pamphlets were Lutheran and a translation of German pamphlets. But by the 1550s then, with this refugee experience, the Reformed churches on the continent, on the model of Geneva or of Zurich, have more influence over those Protestants in England who wanted to purify the Church of England. Now, in the latter 16th century in England, too, this is now, you know, see, the Renaissance is going on at the same time in England. These overlap. They're not necessarily in sequence. In the latter 16th century in England, you also have Jesuits sent out trying to reconvert England to Catholicism, and many of them were martyred. The Catholic Reformation, we can't forget about them, often called the Counter-Reformation, it's a little bit of both, usually is dated from 1545, which was the beginning of the Council of Trent, which lasted for several decades, and was the long last answer of the Pope to the Emperor's desire for a council to try to settle these religious matters. Well, there weren't any Protestants there, or there were a few observers for a while, but it was entirely a Roman council. And what the Council of Trent did over a series of meetings was to solidify the doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church along the lines in general of Thomas Aquinas, and also to try to reform the life and morals of the Church. Now, some of that was negative. One of the things that the Council of Trent did was to, or that the Roman Catholic Church did at this time, was to create an index of books you shouldn't read. And they put Erasmus on the index. And all of that was not in the interests of intellectual liberty. But they did some things that were good. One ruling they passed is that every diocese in which a bishop was to have a seminary. Priests weren't educated before. Some of them went to universities, but not necessarily. And it was recognized that this was a bad thing and they should be educated. So it took a long time to enforce this rule, but the ideal was set up that there should be a seminary in every diocese. So the Council of Trent was one aspect of the Catholic Reformation then. Another aspect was the founding of some new religious orders, like the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus, founded by Ignatius Loyola, a Spaniard. And the Society of Jesus was a great missionary order in Europe, but around the world as well. St. Francis Xavier to India and Matteo Ricci to the Far East. These were early Jesuits. Ignatius Loyola gathered about him in Paris, where he more or less got the group going, a group of very diligent and dedicated people. And they also worked on the continent of Europe in the latter 16th and 17th century to reconvert areas that had become Protestant to Catholicism, and succeeded quite well in some areas, like Austria. So that was the counterpart of the Reformation, the reconversion of Protestant areas. But at the same time, there was a great missionary effort worldwide, not just by the Jesuits. The Franciscans were also great missionaries, and the Dominicans, too, at a time when Protestants weren't producing any foreign missionaries. So new religious orders, the Council of Trent, and then in the 17th century, the Roman Catholic Church has some great social welfare interests. St. Vincent de Paul lived at that time in France, and they did a lot of work with the poor. And it's considered that the Catholic Reformation went on as long as up to the French Revolution, 1789. So if you talk to a Roman Catholic about the Reformation, he might not see it as a Protestant Reformation and is thinking in terms of what Catholics have come to think of as a Catholic Reformation, both with its counter-Reformation tendencies and with its own revival of life from within. Because one of the things they did at this time was to set up schools. The Protestants had set up a lot of schools because one of the things that the Reformation did was to take this educational system of the elite and make it available to everybody, because it was important that everybody should be able to read the Bible, men and women, boys and girls. So schools were set up, and it became noticeable in countries that had become Protestant that there was an increase in average run-of-the-mill literacy, to the point where Scotland, which was a relatively poor, backward country in early modern times, the 17th and 18th century, had the highest literacy rate in Europe, as far as we can tell. So this effort to get everybody to read the Bible and teaching them to read in order to do it actually did have an effect on the literacy rate of Protestant countries. Well, the Roman Catholics eventually got into Bible reading too, although in the 16th century they were sort of opposed to it. They thought of it as a dangerous book. And they set up schools, the Jesuits in particular would set up schools, and this was all a part of what they call the Catholic Reformation. Okay, I guess I took a little bit longer, and we've got something coming up at 10:15. But maybe I can answer a few questions. Oh, I left out the Anabaptists. I was going to include them because one of the first Anabaptists wore a blue coat, and I thought that would be an obvious thing for it. The Anabaptists, usually we think of Zurich, Zwingli Zurich, and there were a number of people in that town who read the Bible and said, aha, no organs in the churches, whitewashing the walls, but there's no infant baptism either. And these people gathered together, and a number of them were rebaptized. Now, that was illegal in Europe. And these people would not recant, and they were evangelizing in this direction. And most of the initial leaders of this group, which was called Anabaptist, Rebaptist, were drowned. Some of them were burned. Some of them fled. But the movement spread throughout Europe, with many drownings and burnings. These people were pacifists. They believed in believer's baptism, as they called it. They believed that you should not be a civil magistrate, and there was a great deal of prejudice and resistance to them, and many of them were killed. So they would go where they could find a peaceful place to be, like the Netherlands, where Menno Simons, who you know from Mennonite fame, a Roman Catholic priest, became an Anabaptist and managed to live out a full life. And his followers were called Mennonites. Some of them later on followed somebody named Hutter and were Hutterites. The tradition of the Anabaptists lives on in the Mennonites and the Hutterites, not so much in the Baptist church. Baptists in America today are more early 17th century English Baptists who accept on the issue of baptism are very Calvinist in their theology. They aren't necessarily pacifists. They aren't opposed to participation in civil government and all these other things that the Mennonites and the Hutterites, the original Anabaptists, were. But anyway, one of these first people that was baptized was called George Blaurock, which apparently meant blue coat, because he had a blue coat.
Would that stand out?
Well, apparently. He was a stranger to the group, and they called him that. There's a very lovely description of it in the Mennonite Chronicle. There are other descriptions of Anabaptists by mainline Protestants, which are less lovely. But it was a very warm experience, this gathering in which this rebaptism occurred.
If I can ask the question, mm-hmm. I'm most interested in visual images.
Uh-huh.
What did it look like? What did they wear or eat?
Okay.
Just whatever you've got to handle.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's take Northern Europe. It was said of 16th century people that they were cold, hungry, and afraid, which was a little bit true. And they wore, sort of voluminous coats. You'll see pictures of of Calvin in a big black kind of coat that goes all the way down, and then pants of some sort underneath and a jacket as well, and this hat that covers up his ears. And you can't go wrong if you wear fur. They wore a lot of furs, and if you were wealthy, it was ermine. And if you've seen pictures of these Renaissance kings, well, like Henry VIII or Francis I, they have these very fancy, from our point of view, practically feminine-looking, elaborate outfits with, tight stockings, and then sometimes very full pantaloons and brocaded jackets. And then the women had gowns down to their ankles. Very fancy in Renaissance Italy, not so in Calvinist Geneva, because that sort of thing was discouraged. You weren't supposed to wear jewelry in Calvinist Geneva. You could wear, that's one of the reasons the watch industry got going. Watches were allowable because they were useful. They weren't just a piece of gold that you were wearing for ornament. Because you should give that money to the poor. It was very practical. A lot of these people were dressed up as monks and nuns for a long time, Luther and his Augustinian outfit. It's somewhat confusing because if you read about what these people wore, you don't understand, because they're talking about pieces of clothing that people don't wear anymore. So you almost have to see a picture to get some idea of what they look like. So you have to look at the art of the period. Figure that out. And not all clergy people dressed up as clergy people. Some of them just wore regular. There was one cardinal at Trent who just wore a red cap and ordinary clothes. I'm going to bother.
How was it that the church had developed such a tremendous power in Europe after the 1500s, the 1400s, the fall of Rome?
Oh, okay, well, the 5th century, the 400s.
Oh, the 5th century, okay.
Well, in Western Europe, because the secular government more or less collapsed in some areas. And the church was well organized enough to carry on some of the functions that the secular government had carried on. Education, welfare. Sometimes the most important and the only educated, literate person around in an area might be a bishop or a priest. And then the Benedictines did a great work in clearing lands in Europe for agriculture. So they had an economic purpose as well. So it was a void, in a sense. Now there were the Roman system of common roads and communication collapsed, and what you had is local lords ruling their own area and. Barbarians moving in after they settled down, Vikings. So there was this constant threat of warfare and attack that kept things very disorganized. Charlemagne in 1800, but then again in the 11th, 12th century and so on, the local secular rulers are becoming more and more powerful and resenting the role that the church has had. But it was not any... power play on their part, particularly. It was just by way of filling a void of government that ceased to exist.
And then they just developed the power by time.
Yeah. In the Eastern Roman Empire, it was a little bit different because the emperor remained, and so the relationship of church and state was somewhat different. The church was a little more subservient to the state, and that wasn't necessarily good either.
Is the Renaissance and Reformation, does it still reflect feudal society in terms of class and arrangements? I mean, is it still lord and peasant, and then within that the rise of merchants in the city-states? What kind of figures would you
Okay, all right. See? You still had serfdom in some areas and lords out in rural areas and the whole manorial system. Within the cities, the cities developing within that. Mm-hmm. So you could be, you mean in terms of what you might, you had the merchants and the artisans and all that growing up in the cities alongside, and then the serfs then were faced with the possibility of escape. I mean, they could move to town, mm-hmm. which hadn't been a possibility before. They were more or less trapped where they were. Because initially, those people that became serfs were looking for protection. And it was in their interest to enter into that system. It was better, or in some ways, it was better than slavery.
Would you say a word about the guilds?
The
types of guilds that there were?
The artisans would form guilds, usually organized around some sort of a craft. And they would make rules about who could become a master craftsman. That's an interesting thing. You would begin as a young person, as an apprentice, as a teenager. And then you would become a journeyman and then a master. And you had to learn to do things of a certain level of skill, and you had to charge a certain fixed price. People in the 16th century and before had the idea that there was a just price for things. They didn't have a concept of inflation. And there was a just price, and you weren't to charge above it, and it was to be of a certain quality. And these guilds provided a social function as well, because the people met together. If you moved from one town to another, you might stay in the guild of a similar trade. And they endowed church windows. They had an important function to play in medieval and Renaissance and Reformation society, although not every town had guilds. Geneva didn't, but Strasbourg did. It depended a little bit on the local situation. Craft guilds, most of them.
What kind of crafts, too, I was thinking?
Okay, well, there were people who made shoes, and there were... people who made shoes, people who made clothing. It was very divided up on the point of view of clothing. There were some people who made ribbon, some people who worked with silk. There wasn't cotton yet, so they used wool, and there would be a weaver's guild, and then there'd be a carter's guild, the various steps in the production of a garment. What else? All the clothing, there would be bakers might be formed into a guild, pin makers, tinsmiths. Some of the guilds women could join, and makers of ribbons, for instance, that was one of the things that women did. Tailors, those were the various things that actually most people did. For lack of manufacture, you know, it wasn't everybody that was so wealthy that they could live off their land, and most people in town had some sort of a craft or another.
What about decorative arts? Is there much of that going on?
Well, in those Italian palaces for the wealthy, you know, they would even paint the walls and have mosaics and the like. But in the average run-of-the-mill home, no. And it depended. Well, for instance, if you were in Nuremberg and Durer was there doing woodcuts, you had somebody like that around.
When you go into these towns, you see the churches and the town halls and the old marked plots and that sort of thing.
The central place was a plot. A plaza was a tradition in many of these cities, particularly Italian cities. They'd use tapestries on the walls, woven tapestries. All of these things were around.
What were the Scandinavian people doing in this time?
Well,
Can I not ask that?
Yeah, you can. They were, up through the 9th, 10th century, they were invading Europe in Viking ships. And then with Christianization, really, they settled down. They became, obviously, Roman Catholic. To the extent that they were Christianized at all until the Protestant Reformation, when they became Protestant and through the influence of Germany and thus Lutheran. Yeah.
I wonder if you'd comment on what you feel the influence of Islam was in some of these events. It seems to me that we live in a time where the rise of the power of that segment in our world is upon us now, and how it seems to me that their threat to the Western world was very significant in some of the happenings during the Reformation era, or setting it up. And
that's a good point. I should have mentioned the Ottoman Empire. Because it was the Ottoman Empire, which was Muslim, pounding on the doors of Europe, almost taking Vienna that kept Charles V from putting down the Protestants. So in the south eastern part of Europe, you had the Turks moving in. And, of course, you had most of the Middle East under the power of various Muslim groups. That had been the reason for the Crusades. They'd hoped to take back the Holy Land. On the continent of Europe itself, there were Muslims in Spain. But by the 1500s, the Spanish had more or less driven them out. Europe, when it picked up again culturally and educationally, drew a lot from what turns out to have been superior Eastern culture. And some of the manuscripts they got, or the mathematics, surely, and so on, came from that part of the world. Yeah.
Well, there had been an Islamic invasion from North Africa via Spain that Charlemagne or...
Well, 732, Charles Martel stopped them. Yeah, and in at Tours in France.
The Song of Roland is from that time.
But then they were pushed back into Spain.
Yeah.
They were seen as a threat, except for these cultural things that Europeans wanted to copy. And there were philosophers like Averroes, some of the learning of Islamic scholars was absorbed into Europe in the medieval period.
When was it that all those medical textbooks were burned in Alexandria? Is their medical advances were just really remarkable as compared to...
I mean, is it part of the Crusades? It seems to me I vaguely remember something like that, but I don't remember any particular date. Well, we are back on schedule.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for this session. Yeah.